Welcome to the Hannah Miller Show. And here she is, Hannah Miller.
Outspokenly conservative and unashamedly Christian, this is Hannah Miller, and this is what happened this week. So just days after PolitiFact, a fact-checking organization that works closely with Facebook, was forced to walk back a fact check on a claim made on Tucker Carlson's Fox News show related to the origins of SARS-CoV-2, Facebook announced the following. Quote, in light of ongoing investigations into the origin of COVID-19 and in consultation with public health experts, we will no longer remove the claim that COVID-19 is man-made or manufactured from our apps, the post reads. We're continuing to work with health experts to keep pace with the evolving nature of the pandemic and regularly update our policies as new facts and trends emerge. End quote. So essentially, last year, quite a few people, one of the main folks being Tucker Carlson, questioned the origins of COVID-19. And of course, it supposedly came from some bat in a wet market. Well, that's all in shambles now. And people questioned that because of a lab that was there that Anthony Fauci is closely tied to. He sent United States funding to this lab. And Tucker Carlson talked about all of that last year, brought it to people's attention, and it was fact-checked on Facebook and on other social media platforms and labeled a conspiracy theory and fake news, that it was a lie, etc. And now, PolitiFact and Facebook and others, they're having to walk that back because of what's happened this past week, which is that the origins of the coronavirus COVID-19 have begun to have a lot of questions. And there's just a lot of evidence that's going in the other direction, that this was man-made, that it did come out of a lab in Wuhan. And all of the things that some of us were saying from the very beginning of this, or not from the very beginning, but very early on, we were saying about this and drawing those ties to Anthony Fauci. And so now they're having to walk that back. And it's just aspect after aspect of this whole coronavirus thing, you know, you go all the way back from the origins of it now to when did it actually start, to, you know, hydroxychloroquine, to ivermectin, to vaccines, to every bit of it that mainstream media and social media platforms tried to label as conspiracy theory. You know, it's just a conspiracy theory, but just give it 3 to 6 months. You know, and then it's going to be the truth. And so anyway, all of this just to say that I'm excited to inform you that we are now permitted to think out loud regarding the origins of COVID-19. Only the origins now. Hopefully, eventually, we will get to the point where we can think out loud about the vaccines and about other aspects of it. But so that happened this week. Another story that happened this week was Patrice Cullors resigned from the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation after weeks of criticism surrounding her million-dollar real estate purchases. So she's been at the helm of Black Lives Matter's Global Network Foundation for 6 years, and she told the Associated Press that, I've created the infrastructure and the support and the necessary bones and foundation so that I can leave, and it feels like the time is right. So in April, Cullors, to give a little backstory, who's a self-described Marxist, by the way, was heavily criticized after it was discovered that she had purchased a $1.4 million home in a predominantly white neighborhood of Los Angeles. And a later report said that she had purchased 4 high-end homes totaling more than $3.2 million. So in her comments to the AP, Cullors characterized the criticism as coming from the right and claimed that the decision to leave the group had nothing to do with the controversy. She said, those were right-wing attacks that tried to discredit my character, and I don't operate off of what the right thinks about me. Cullors also posted a video to her YouTube account about her resignation and only vaguely referenced the controversy from her home purchase. And she goes on, she used an expletive, so I won't exactly quote it. But the Black Lives Matter Foundation revealed to the AP that they had garnered $90 million in donations just in 2020. And the official Twitter account of Black Lives Matter tweeted a statement praising Cullors after she announced her resignation, saying, after almost 8 years, we say see you later to the last of our our founders, Patrice Cullors, who served Black Lives Matter wholeheartedly. We reflect on the impact Patrice had on BLM, and we are in deep gratitude, they tweeted. So she's claiming that it had nothing to do with, it was just time to resign. This had nothing to do with the kind of the scandal of all of this money. I don't know. That's her claim. Probably does have something to do, but who knows? But anyway, she's out at Black Lives Matter. I don't know who they're going to, if they're going to try to have other leadership that comes in. But that organization is definitely something that we as Christians and conservatives do not get behind and do not support because of all of the things that they actively attack that are important to us. And that would be the nuclear family. That would be Christianity. That would be not being racist because they clearly are. They're anti-white. So anyway, then that's a conversations for other days. We've had many of those conversations on Tony and Hannah when I was with Dr. Beam, and Dad and I have had those conversations as well on his show, More Than Medicine. So I won't dive into all of that, but there's a lot of information out there about the origins of Black Lives Matter and the two women that founded the organization 6 to 8 years ago. So moving on, months after recovering from mild cases of COVID-19, people still have immune cells in their body pumping out antibodies against the virus that causes COVID-19, according to a study from researchers at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. Such cells could persist for a lifetime, churning out antibodies all the while. The findings, published May 24th in the journal Nature, suggest that mild cases of COVID-19 leave those infected with lasting antibody protection, and that repeated bouts of illness are likely to be uncommon. Quote, last fall, there were reports that antibodies wane quickly after infection with the virus that causes COVID-19, and mainstream media interpreted that to mean that immunity was not long-lived, said senior author Ali Elbadi, an associate professor of pathology and immunology of medicine and of molecular microbiology. She said, she continued by saying, but that's a misinterpretation of the data. It's normal for antibody levels to go down after acute infection, but they don't go down to zero. They plateau. Here, we find antibody-producing cells in people 11 months after first symptoms. These cells will live and produce antibodies for the rest of people's lives. That's strong evidence for long-lasting immunity. End quote. So again, like she just clearly put, people were trying to say, oh, your antibodies are only going to last for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. It varied on who you talked to. And so that was one of the reasons everybody said, even if you've already had COVID-19, you need to get the vaccine. But now we've got studies coming out, and this is just one of many that are saying, hey, look, folks that had it 11 months ago and folks who had very mild cases of it. Because that was another aspect of it that people tried to argue, that those who were asymptomatic or those who had very mild cases, they weren't going to have enough antibodies to be able to have immunity. But that's been debunked now from this study. And this was backed up by Dr. Marty Makary from Johns Hopkins, who stated, I never thought I'd say this, but please ignore the CDC guidance. Advising Americans to live a normal life unless you are unvaccinated and did not have the infection, in which case you need to be careful. Makary called the CDC's outright dismissal of natural immunity one of the biggest failures of our current medical leadership. He pointed out that the CDC amazingly offers no guidance for individuals who have recovered from COVID-19 in regard to what they can safely do. Natural immunity works. We've got to start respecting individuals who choose not to get the vaccine instead of demonizing them. There's more data on natural immunity than there is on vaccinated immunity because natural immunity has been around longer, he continued, noting that both vaccination and previous infection likely provide lifelong immunity from the virus. He added that reinfection is extremely rare, and even when it does happen, the symptoms are mild or those individuals are asymptomatic. That's one of the things I've been asking for months. When people were saying, hey, you know, yeah, I had COVID-19, but I'm definitely going to get that vaccine because my antibodies are going to, they're going to fade. They're going to go away. I'm not going to have them for longer than, 30 days or 60 days or whatever number they had in their mind. And I just thought, well, where are the thousands and thousands of people that are getting reinfected? Because, you know, even in the fall of last year, you know, we had the virus starting in January, February, really started getting going, February, March. So we had months then to see, okay, how long do these antibodies last? And nobody was looking at that and saying, well, wait a minute. Yeah. What about the people who survived it from February and March? Now it's October. So obviously their antibodies, if they've not gotten it again, are lasting for longer than 30, 60, or 90 days. But doing antibody studies and looking at people who had previously had COVID-19 just never occurred to some folks. And even if it did and they decided to look into it, their findings never interested the mainstream and the powers that be at the CDC and Anthony Fauci. It was one of, in my opinion, the most pressing questions of last year. Once that discussion arose about vaccines and how long the immunity would last. And so now we've got two experts and a study that are saying, hey, we can't dismiss natural immunity, even if you had a very mild case. So that's great news for folks. All right. So this is the story that I kind of want to hunker down into today. And this is from Manhattan. And here's the backstory. And then we're going to dive in and I'm going to talk about it for a little while. Parents of students attending Columbia Grammar and Preparatory School in Manhattan were furious after the school forced students to take an explicit class on pornography without parental consent. The school at first denied hosting the workshop, then later apologized. The school, which involved a slideshow and a lecture by the class, which involved a slideshow and a lecture by an instructor, featured raunchy images and presentations on porn genres and OnlyFans, a subscription website that's largely used for pornography. The New York Post detailed the workshop, saying the often explicit slide presentation and lecture by Fonte to the 120 boys and girls included lessons on how porn takes care of three big male vulnerabilities, that's all in quotes, statistics on the orgasm gap, showing straight men have far fewer orgasms with their partners than gay men or women, and photos of partially nude women, some in bondage, to analyze, quote, what is porn and what is art, end quote. Fonte's presentation, some of which was seen by the Post, included a list of the most searched pornographic terms of 2019. I'm not going to say all of them, but it included things like gangbang, stepmom, more. One slide cited various porn genres such as incest-themed, consensual, vanilla, barely legal, and kink and BDSM, which included waterboard electro torture porn, as an example. Real disgusting stuff. The workshop was designed and taught by Justine Ang Fonte, the health director of Dalton, another top prep school. Tuition at Columbia cost $47,000 per year. Juniors at Columbia were forced to watch the presentation online, at home for those on Zoom, and in the school's gymnasium for those attending school in person at the time. Parents found out about the course because of students being forced to watch it over Zoom. Quote, it's outrageous that the school is introducing pornography into a mainstream classroom and starting to indoctrinate kids. The goal of this is to disrupt families, one parent of a student at Columbia Prep told the Post. Why is the school making porn a priority as opposed to physics, art, literature, or poetry? Another parent said that parents are afraid to speak out against subjects being taught at the school for fear of being canceled, saying, most parents feel the same way I do about not going public, but at the same time, we're incredibly frustrated by what's going on. None of the parents knew this was planned. We were completely left in the dark. It makes us wonder what else the school is up to, she said. A spokesman for the school at first denied that the students were ever exposed to such raunchy content. Columbia head William Donahue later reversed himself and apologized for hosting the class after the Post story on it ran Saturday. The, quote, content and tone of the presentation did not represent our philosophy, which is to educate our students in ways that promote their personal development and overall health, as well as to express respect for them as individuals, Donahue said in an email to parents. It was unfortunate that we did not better inform ourselves of the speaker's specific content in advance, he continued. In this case, the speaker did not align with our unique CGPS mission, and for this, I apologize. Pornographic content was introduced into the curriculum of a Texas school as well earlier this year. Parents of students in the Leander Independent School District in Austin complained about explicit content being taught to teens, but their complaints in some cases were met with derision and mocking. Over at the Daily Wire, they reported that according to one parent who spoke to the Daily Wire on condition of remaining anonymous, their concerns were not received with tolerance by some involved in the process. Proponents of the pornographic content, allegedly including both teachers and parents, lashed out at the concerned parents, calling them religious zealots, bigots, and racists. The harassment did not end at name-calling. They were also, in other words that I'm not going to repeat on my podcast because I don't cite them. Some of the people speaking out have received anonymous cardboard genitalia in the mail with anti-Christian messages calling them names, and then I'm not going to repeat what some of these words are, but they're other names for genitalia, one concerned parent told the Daily Wire. Others have received dead animals on their porches, the parent claimed. So that's the backstory. First of all, it doesn't surprise me that there are schools that are doing things behind your back. Big surprise, big whoop, not surprised by that at all. Their schools are doing a lot of things behind your back. And I think there's a lot of parents that realized this last year because of Zoom and because of having their kids being at home and the parents being at home and seeing some of the content. It's why you've seen a kind of a flush of parents and families deciding to homeschool this last year. Then they pretty much outright lied and said, you know, now first they tried to hide it and then they lied about it. And then when it became obvious that they couldn't lie about it, they just kind of tried to take most of the responsibility away from themselves by saying, well, it was a mistake. We didn't know what was going to be on here. I don't really care. Unless he came in and talked about something, you know, talked about pornography when he was supposed to come in and talk about geography. And he totally lied to you about what the content of his presentation was going to be. You, in some way, were aware that he was coming in to talk about pornography, the internet, sexuality, something that the parents should have been made aware of. So you're not completely off of the hook, in my opinion. I don't think there's any way for the school to be off of the hook and try to act like, you know, we invited him in, but we had no idea. What, you just had no idea what he was going to talk about? If he'd indicated in any way at all what he was going to talk about, the truth about what he was going to talk about, you would know that this was something that the parents should know about. So let me share a couple of different things. When I was 7, we moved to what my dad lovingly called a, quote, a gentleman's farm, which meant we had dogs, horses, and a garden, all of which we somehow miraculously kept alive for the most part. And despite living on a farm in the middle of nowhere, homeschooling, attending a biblical church full of like-minded families, and having zero internet in our home because we lived out in the sticks, that summer I was at a friend's grandparents' house near our new home, and in their basement, floor-to-ceiling, wall-to-wall, were Playboy magazines. So yeah, as you can guess, I was exposed to pornography. At the tender age of 7, sexuality, nudity, and objectification were thrown in my face during an innocent game of hide-and-seek when I had found a place behind a chair to hide that happened to be up against this these walls of magazines. Thankfully, it did not create a pornography addiction in my life, but I will say it awakened my awareness of sexuality earlier than probably would have happened naturally as a child. I tell you all this because this story, in conjunction with the one from Manhattan, brings a couple of things to my mind regarding protecting our children from the awakening of sexuality too early. Parents must do two things: be both preventative and proactive. So I'm not going to get into the nitty-gritty of this conversation. I think I did that on my dad's podcast last year, and I'll do it again here on this podcast at some point later on, but we'll save that for another day. Because today I want to address the two broad aspects of prevention and proaction, and then I want to discuss something that really stood out to me regarding this story from Manhattan that has become a bit of a theme among parents in similar situations, but we'll get to that. So regarding preventative measures, I want to say a couple of things. First, You can do all the right things as a parent and take all the correct precautions to prevent premature exposure, but it may not be enough. Our adversary, the devil, is prowling around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour, 1 Peter 5:8. Satan is actively looking for a vulnerable child or adult whom he can ensnare. This is why being a praying parent that persistently prays against the enemy getting a single toehold in our children's lives is imperative. The scriptures tell us the prayers of a righteous man availeth much. Be a righteous parent who petitions the Lord every day, more than once, on behalf of your children. Second, children do make their own choices, and they do have their own sin nature. This is really an entirely different conversation, so I'll mainly be coming from the perspective of children who find sexuality thrust upon them unwittingly, but it does bear mentioning at least briefly. A child's proclivity to sin, nor the prowling of Satan, absolves a parent of their responsibility to protect with preventative measures. Our responsibility in this area as parents is to do all that we can to place a hedge of protection around our children, no matter our children's sin nature and no matter what temptation Satan may present. Your child's sin nature and the actions of Satan are out of your control, but whether you pray for your child or not, and whether or not you place specific lines of protection around your home, are what you will stand before God and be held accountable for one day. So preventative measures involve careful consideration of every entryway to your home. And by that, I mean doors, phones, TVs, computers, text messages, internet. Think about all of the ways a predator, lies, or our enemy Satan can enter your home and get in front of your child. These measures involve careful consideration over who you invite into your home that is left unmonitored around your children, and those homes and whose homes you allow your child to go to. And I say this, I want to make sure. You know, when I was growing up, my parents were very ministry-minded. We have people in and out of our home all of the time who were, they had all kinds of sin issues. People that were in and out of jail, people that were in and on and off drugs, people that were alcoholics. You know, we've recently become very good friends with a man who was a convicted murderer. Spent 40-something years in jail for murder. Of course, he got saved while he was in jail. He's a radically transformed human being now. But that was the way that I grew up, was to be around folks, frequently around folks, who had major sin issues in their lives that potentially could have been a danger to all of us. But see, as I said earlier, they were not left unmonitored around us. They were welcomed into our home, to spend time with our family, to have dinner with us, typically was the setup. But they were not just allowed to roam freely in our home. And I shouldn't use that word allowed. They just weren't left unattended. You know, it wasn't like my parents sat them down and were like, hey, here's the rules of our home. You can't be around our kids by your... No, I mean, they just were careful not to leave us alone with somebody that they didn't know very well. They were trying to minister to, who might have potentially been a danger. So I don't want you to feel like you can't invite these people into your home that you desperately need to be ministering to as an evangelist, as a disciple maker. You need to do those things. And it's good for your children to be involved in that ministry as well. Just don't leave them unmonitored. Don't leave your children unmonitored around them. And think carefully, as I said, the last part of that, on whose home you allow your child to go to. These measures also include internet filters, internet accessibility, technology accessibility, period, movies, music, TV shows, etc. that you allow into your home, social media apps. Again, I could dive into the nitty-gritty of this. I'm not going to do that today. That's just a real vague overview. The rule in our house growing up, though, was you didn't need a phone until you were driving. And you know what? That's still true. Your child who cannot drive should never be anywhere where there is an adult, where there is not an adult that you trust in attendance that cannot lend him their phone in case of emergency. I know that this is a foreign concept these days because 6-year-olds have cell phones, but it's still true. Whether your child is at school, church, a party, or a sports practice, there should be an adult there that you trust and from whom you have received permission for your child to use their device if need be. Also, lock all devices after a certain time of day in your home. Devices should not be present at the dinner table, nor should they be taken into bedrooms to be privately used. Sin loves darkness and solitude. That is where it thrives. Do not make accommodations for sin in your home by allowing any kind of device, television, phone, iPad, computers, to be taken into darkness and solitude where light and accountability are not welcome. Just as you would not allow a stranger from the street to enter your daughter's dark bedroom at 2 a.m. completely alone, do not accommodate electronic devices that can be a portal for danger either. All right, so those are the preventative. To be proactive, it is absolutely necessary for us as parents to understand if we do not teach our children the truth about sexuality, the world will lie to them about it. Not only must we teach them the truth, we must teach them the truth before the lies have a chance to deceive. This is how we as parents can be proactive. We must teach them, and we must teach them first. Often attributed to Mark Twain is the quote, "It's easier to fool someone than to convince them that they have been fooled." Whether Twain truly said it or not, the principle still stands. Once someone believes something is true, it's very difficult to unravel those tentacles. Don't let the world, a teacher, a coach, a television show, a TikTok video, or an Instagram ad deceive your child before you have instilled the truth in them. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that you have to sit down and have the birds and the bees talk with your six-year-old, but it does mean you should be raising them to know that God made man. He created them in his own likeness. Male and female, he created them. This doesn't require an awkward conversation nor premature exposure to sexuality, but it starts here with this verse from Genesis. And this fact alone circumvents arguments that support homosexuality, bisexuality, lesbianism, transgenderism, and all of the gender identities, how many ever there are out there now. Don't leave these conversations to their Sunday school teacher or Awana's class or some sex ed class at school, because that's going to be a disaster. It is your job as the parent to teach truth to your children, and not just once, but as Deuteronomy says, "These words I'm commanding you today are to be upon your hearts, and you shall teach them diligently to your children and speak of them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up." The scripture clearly tells us that teaching our children truth is no one else's responsibility but ours, and it's more than just a one-time conversation as we drive to Sunday school. It's day in and day out, teaching them how the truths of scripture apply to life. Look, if you consistently teach through the scriptures with your children, there are all kinds of topics that are going to come up that will require a little bit of explanation that will help them create building blocks for understanding, quote, the birds and the bees. The virgin birth, for one. I mean, we just did, you know, Christmas was just, what, 5-6 months ago? I've got a six-year-old, and, well, what does it mean when Mary's a virgin? Well, you know, and you have to give at least some sort of vague description when they're real young, and it sets the groundwork for later, and we'll talk about that in a second. But there are a lot of good resources out there to equip parents to teach the scriptures. I recommend the Well-Trained Minds curriculum titled Telling God's Story. It comes with a parent guide, teacher manual, and a little activity book for your child. And there's, if you have young children, they have older ones for older children. So they've got different, you know, kind of all through school age. But it's not overwhelming for you as the parent. They often have a paragraph or two. The parent can read in advance to help them formulate their thoughts, but the curriculum itself really does most of the work, and it truly helps parents to apply scripture to everyday life and help their children understand, you know, what certain things mean, why certain things are important. So I think it's a really great tool for parents. So we're starting it ourselves, actually, with our kids as soon as our copy comes. It's been ordered for a couple of weeks. So I'm going to try to give like a full-on review later on, but it comes highly recommended, and the multiple lessons that I have read and I have used before are superlative. So there's also some great tools out there to help you teach your children about this topic. Focus on the Family has a great list, but truly, God's Word is the best tool for teaching our children the truth about sexuality. I will say, you probably need to have the talk, the birds and the bees talk, with your children earlier than you think you do. Most experts believe parents should be having this discussion with their kids around the age of 8, at least in a superficial way. Like I said earlier, you know, the virgin birth, for example, when my kids asked about that at Christmas, well, what does it mean for Mary to have to have been a virgin? You know, we didn't get into the nitty gritty of that. We just gave a very superficial explanation, and she was only six. And that's all she needed. So, especially though, you need to be having this conversation if your hand has been forced by something your child has been exposed to prematurely, like I was at age 7. And a lot of kids are these days. Now, age 8 is not a hard and fast rule, but because of the culture we live in that inundates our children with sexuality, and because it's imperative we as the parents be the first to broach the topic with our children, we can't put this conversation off until they're 16. I mean, that's a lot of parents out there, they're just leaving it up to the schools for whenever it comes up, or hoping that they get something from the youth pastor at some point, or their Sunday school class, or they're thinking, okay, yeah, when they're 12 or 13. It's too late by then, honestly, because the lies of the world will, in most cases, 99% of the time, by the time that your child is 12, 13, 14, they're already going to have been exposed to some form of sexuality, nudity, something by the world that's going to have corrupted the foundation of what they believe about sexuality. Okay? You do need to gauge each child's readiness. Some children may mature earlier than others, so the age can vary some. Like I said, 8's not a hard and fast rule, and some things may come up in one child's life that forces you to address it earlier than you would like, or at least superficially, like I said. You just gauge your child's readiness, their level of maturity, the questions that they're asking. You know, you don't want to avoid their questions, but the younger they are, the more superficial the questions can be and should be. But as they grow older, the more specific, the more details, the more you need to have those conversations with your children. But if you're going through the scriptures, teaching through the scriptures, as you should be as a parent, then those conversations will come up and you can have them more in depth as your children grow. Because you should be going through the scriptures day in and day out. You're going to go through the Bible multiple times in the course of their life. One last thing on this. Furthermore, never shirk from calling the male-female genitalia by its scientific name. I've told my children the correct scientific names for their body parts, but I also tell them some people are uncomfortable with these terms, and so we have other, what I'll call gentler terms for conversation if they need to tell me something. Experts have proven, though, that children who know the scientific names for their body parts are more protected from predators because these children can correctly identify where someone has touched them, and it tends to put a barrier up between them and predators. So that's just kind of a side note. So lastly, let me share another story from my own life that connects to this particular story from Manhattan in a bit of a different way. I remember once when I was in high school, some friends were going somewhere that I did not feel comfortable going. I can't even remember now where it was, but I remember I shared with my dad where we wanted to go, where they wanted to go, and why I felt uncomfortable, which means it must not have been because it was somewhere bad. Otherwise, my parents would have put the kibosh on that. But there was something about it that I didn't like. So anyway, as a teenager, I didn't want to be the odd man out, and I didn't want to spoil my friend's fun. By not going, but for the most part, I was not a kid that was influenced by peer pressure much. But there was a bit of it there that day, and I remember not wanting to seem, you know, quote, lame to my friends. I'll never forget my dad's response. He said, "Hannah, if you don't feel comfortable telling them, you make me the bad guy. I don't care what your little friends or their parents think or say about me. It's no skin off my back. If you tell them, you can't go because your dad won't let you. If you need to hide behind me, you're welcome to do it." My dad had my back. He didn't care what other people called him or said about him. He wasn't afraid to do what was right. In that story from Manhattan, and in numerous other stories across the country that I've come across regarding either the issue of the LGBTQ+ agenda being taught in schools, critical race theory being taught in schools, or porn disguised as sex ed, the parents have all been afraid to speak out. Afraid of what people would say about them, afraid of losing their jobs, afraid of being canceled, afraid of their kids being blackballed from the elite schools and colleges. They were afraid. And their children were the ones who bore the consequences because they couldn't handle people falsely slandering them. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. That's Matthew 5, 11 through 12. I called my friends that evening and told them I wasn't going because I didn't think it was an appropriate event for us, even though their parents gave them permission. I remember not even using my dad as an excuse because I realized I wanted to do what was right, no matter what people called me or said about me, even their parents. Because see, by me, a teenager, essentially saying, I don't think we should go, it was a bit of an insult to their parents who thought it was fine. And I'm sure that they felt, they were upset that, well, what is this little teenager thing? That we can't make these, that we're not smart enough or wise enough. So that was a big part. I think it was more to do with the parents and their response to me saying I wasn't comfortable versus what my friend said. But I wanted to be like my dad. And I also knew that my incredibly wise dad was in my corner. My dad didn't even know it, but this was a turning point for me. And it was one that so strengthened my character that later in life, when it was discovered one of my friends was sneaking out at night to hook up with unsavory characters, her parents came to me privately and told me, she told us you were the only friend that didn't know because she knew you would have done the right thing and told us. And then when I was in college, I discovered a young man on a local basketball team was smoking weed and drinking alcohol underage. But because he was a first-string basketball player, no one would report it because they didn't want him kicked off the basketball team. I immediately picked up the phone and called an adult in his life. I think it was the assistant coach. I knew the basketball team was important and their record and their playing ability, but the long-term consequences of smoking weed and underage drinking were far more important. You can call me a snitch or whatever you want. I didn't care what my friends said, or their parents, or any of the kids on that team. And it goes back to watching my dad being willing to take the flack for me and being willing to do what was right and stand up for what was right, no matter what people said about him. So to my point, stand up for your kids. Stand up for what's good and right, no matter what it costs you. Don't be afraid of school teachers, other kids' parents, your pastor, a coach, the media, a journalist, a doctor, or even your child's youth pastor, because they're not the one you will ultimately have to answer to. Let them say whatever they want about you. As a matter of fact, embrace it, because it's only going to get worse in our culture. But you stand between your child and the lion seeking to devour him. The world's condemnation is but for a moment, but the Lord's blessing lasts for eternity. And when you have the courage to stand up for what's right, your kids just might as well. The next verse in Matthew 5 says, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot." I'm telling you, when you refuse to stand up for the truth and refuse to boldly protect your children from evil in this world, you are refusing to stand up for the truth and the way and the life and are good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. These verses don't just mean we are blessed when people insult us for believing in Jesus. They also mean we are blessed when people revile us for standing for all the good and right things that Jesus calls us to uphold. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven.
Thank you for listening to The Hannah Miller Show. Please remember to subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is produced by Bob Sloan Audio Productions. If you'd like to find out more about Hannah or to schedule her for a speaking event, go to her website, thehannahmillershow.com.